occupation of Palestine. He also sold $650 million worth of missiles to Saudi Arabia, which is dropping bombs on the people of Yemen with the help of the US and European allies. And these are just a few examples of Biden's militarism. Yet every single election year, they tell us to vote Democrat. But the way I see it and the way that it is evil is evil, whether it's red or blue. And both the Democrats and Republicans work together for their common interests of settler colonialism and imperialism. And why should we vote for evil? Why should we vote for evil? All this, it really just exposes America for what it is. Because in reality, America is simply a one-party state. And the ones who are in control are the corporations who make billions upon billions of dollars off of exploiting the people. And it's up to the people to make the changes. As it's very clear, it's clear today that both the Republicans and the Democrats are two settler parties and will never be interested in freedom and independence for the people. We must become our own liberators and free the land from Euro-American control. This is Power to the People.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new study published in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows that keeping global warming below the key 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold by the end of the century will require not just halting the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure, but also shutting down many existing sites. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Study Warns Many Fossil Fuel Sites Must Be Shut Down to Avert Climate Disaster. Here's more. A new study published recently in the journal Environmental Research Letters shows that keeping global warming below the key 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold by the end of the century will require not just halting the construction of new fossil fuel infrastructure, but also shutting down many existing sites. Led by Kelly Trout of Oil Exchange International, the study estimates that 40% of fossil fuel reserves at currently operational development sites across the globe must be left in the ground if the world is to have a 50-50 chance of adequately slashing carbon emissions and limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or below. If fossil fuel reserves at existing sites are extracted, the researchers find nations will substantially exceed the 1.5 degrees Celsius carbon budget that corporations and governments are already burning through at an unsustainable clip. The paper, which relies on a commercial model of the world's 25,000 oil and gas fields, leaves unanswered the question of precisely which existing development sites should be shut down, noting that it requires considerations of equity and of the best mechanisms to manage a just transition away from fossil fuel jobs and revenues within and between countries. One recent analysis suggests that some of the largest fossil fuel companies in the world are planning or already operating more than 190 carbon bombs, huge oil and gas projects that could unleash nearly 650 billion tons of CO2 emissions and doom efforts to avert climate catastrophe. Our findings show that halting new extraction projects is a necessary step, but it's still not enough to stay within our rapidly dwindling carbon budget, said Greg Mutich of the International Institute for Sustainable Development, a co-author of the new study, adding some existing fossil fuel licenses and production will need to be revoked and phased out early. Mutich added governments need to start tackling head-on how to do this in a fair and equitable way, which will require overcoming opposition from fossil fuel interests. The research comes as the fossil fuel industry is exploiting to lobby for new fossil fuel development. In late March, the Biden administration pledged to ramp up U.S. gas exports to European Union members as they attempt to wean themselves off of Russian fossil fuels. Climate advocates warned that the White House's initiative would likely spur the construction of new pipelines and other fossil fuel infrastructure, potentially locking in more planet-warming pollution, as scientists say emissions must be halved by 2030. Our study reinforces that building new fossil fuel infrastructure is not a viable response to the conflict in Eastern Europe, said Trout, Oil Change International Research Co-Director, adding, the world has already tapped too much oil, gas, and coal. Developing more would either cause more dangerous levels of warming if fully extracted or create a larger scale of standard assets. Therese van der Graaf of Ghent University in Belgium, a study co-author, similarly cautioned that each new coal mine, gas well, or oil field that is developed deepens political entanglement with the fossil fuel industry. Increasing the scale of extraction-related jobs and investments, he added, only makes it harder for governments to manage.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Allah, you are our true guide.
To the redeemer of human volition. mission and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. The listeners, today we'll discuss about the father of Imam Zaman, Ajallah ta'ala farajahum. And on that note, today in our studio we have with us Islamic researcher Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to our program. Dr. Karimi, as you have done extensive research in the field of Mehtawiyat, so we love to do these discussions with you. There's a claim in the Wahhabi school of thought, or many Sunni scholars even say that the father of Imam Zaman is, his name is Abdullah, while us Shias believe something else. I would want you to expand this note. What is it? Why do they say like that?
Sure. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is a very important question, and I think we need to talk about all the aspects related to this question, because today we see that many of our Sunni brothers and also many Wahhabis, as you rightly mentioned, they reject, the Mahdi of Shia because of the claim that the father of Mahdi, his name should be Abdullah.
Okay.
And the father of Imam Mahdi is Imam al-Hasan al-Askari alayhi salam, so he cannot be the promised Mahdi. And unfortunately, it's getting somehow widespread among the Muslims that the name of the Imam Mahdi's father is Abdullah. And this is because of some narrations in Sunni sources that inshallah we will talk about.
True.
Now, just to mention one of the Salafi scholars referring to that, I may refer to Ibn Taymiyyah, the forefather of Wahhabi school of thought. In his famous book, Minhaj al-Sunnah, he says that the Twelver, that is the, 12 Shias, they claim that their Mahdi is Muhammad bin al-Hasan. Then he wants to reject this idea, and he says that والمهدي المنعوت الذي وصفه النبي اسمه محمد بن عبد الله. While the Mahdi that is introduced by the Prophet, his name is Muhammad son of Abdullah. And we have some narrations referring to this point, but the Shia, they have removed that part from those narrations. So somehow he claims, Ibn Taymiyyah claims that the Shia, they have distorted the narrations,
right,
which say that the name of the father of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
So that's claim after claim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is mentioned by Ibn Taymiyyah in Minhaj al-Sunnat al-Nabawiyyah, volume 8, page 254. Now, the point is that there are a couple of narrations in Sunni sources which contain this part. Let me again refer to what Ibn Taymiyyah says in this regard. He says that the narrations about Mahdi are famous. They are narrated by Imam Ahmad, Abu Dawood, Tirmidhi, and others, like the narration of Abdullah bin Mas'ud from the Prophet, who says the following: لَوْ لَمْ يَبْقَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا إِلَّا يَوْمٌ. If there remains only one day for this world, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will prolong that day, so much so that he will send Rajulan min Ahl Bayti, a man from my progeny, Yuato ismuhu ismi, his name is like my name, that is Muhammad, wa ismu abihi ismu abi, his father's name is like my father's name, that is Abdullah. يَمْلَوُ الْأَرْضَ قِسْتًا وَعَدْلًا كَمَا مُلَأَدْ ظُلْمًا وَجَوْرًا. And that Mahdi will fill the earth with justice as it was filled with oppression and injustice.
Injustice.
We need to analyze this claim by Ibn Taymiyyah. First of all, he says that the viewpoint of the Shia is against these narrations. And second of all, he claims that the Shia, they have distorted those narrations, and they have omitted that part from those narrations. Now, first of all, the first point is that as Shia, we know for sure that the father of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam. This is mentioned in many narrations by the Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. And there is no trace of any such narration in Shi'i sources. So
right.
As far as we are concerned, I mean, everything is clear. And we may not need to answer this question because these narrations are mentioned only by some of the Sunni scholars.
All right.
And as Shia, they are not, authentic narrations for us. But anyway, we want to try to answer this question from a Sunni perspective too, to see whether these narrations from Sunni scholars' viewpoint
do they have some authenticity or not.
Yeah.
Dr. Karimi, we'll answer that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior, and we are today talking about the father of Imam Zaman, Ajallah Ta'ala Farajah. Dr. Karimi, you said that Ibn Taymiyyah, the forefather of Wahhabiyyah, he says in his book Manhaj al-Sunnah that the father of Imam Zaman is Abdullah, not Hasan Askari, as Shia say. You said none of the Shia sources says that, and there are many other claims that Shias have distorted the narrations and all. And now you were about to answer a very important question. I would want you to continue.
First of all, let's begin by answering the second claim of Ibn Taymiyyah. He claims that the Shia, they have distorted this narration and they have omitted that part. Wa ismu abihi ismu abi. They have omitted this part from the narration. Is it true? The first point is that we have so many narrations in Sunni sources in which this part is not found.
Oh.
I mean, Ismu Abi, his father's name is like my father's name is not found in any of those authentic narrations, which I will mention in details. So to claim that the Shia, they have distorted the narrations, is absolutely false, because we see the same narrations in Sunni sources. In those narrations, we have only this phrase, Ismuhu Ismi. His name is like my name. But there is no mention of the father's name.
All right.
Technically speaking, these narrations are so many that they are called mustafil, meaning that they are not mutawatir, but a level before mutawatir, widely transmission of the narrations.
All right.
So, first of all, I would like to mention those narrations in Sunni sources in which we do not find the phrase, his father's name is like my father's name. We have some authentic narrations among these narrations. Then we will go to the next part, how to analyze those narrations in which we have that part.
Yeah.
The narrations in which we have only the phrase, ismuhu ismi, his name is like my name, and there is no mention of the father's name, they are quoted from different companions of the Prophet. One of them is Abu Huraira. He has mentioned this narration, Ismuhu Ismi, without Ismu Abihi, Ismu Abi. And many Sunni scholars, well-known Sunni scholars of Hadith, they have quoted this narration from Abu Huraira. For example, I would like to mention the narration of Tirmidhi, the famous Sunni scholar of Hadith. In his book, Sunan at-Tirmidhi, Volume 4, page 505, he quotes the following narration from Abu Huraira. Now, according to him, he says, يَلِي رَجُلٌ مِّنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِي, a man from my progeny will come, يُوَاطُ إِسْمُهُ إِسْمِي, his name is like my name, and لَوْ لَمْ يَبْقَ مِنَ الدُّنْيَا إِلَّا يَوْمْ لَتَوَالُ اللَّهُ ذَلِكَ الْيَوْمِ, and the rest of the narration. So in this narration, the Holy Prophet only refers to the fact that his name is like my name. Then Tirmidhi says that هذا حديث حسن صحيح. So according to Tirmidhi, this is an authentic narration. This is very important because Later, when we analyze those narrations in which the name of the father of Imam Mahdi is mentioned, we need to analyze whether those are authentic or not. We'll prove that none of them is authentic.
True.
But when it comes to this narration, Tirmidhi testifies that this is an authentic narration. Not only him, Albani, one of the contemporary Wahhabi scholars, he mentions that the narration is authentic and the chain is sahih, authentic. Ibn al-Athir al-Jazari is the second Sunni scholar who has narrated this narration from Abu Huraira in his Mu'jam Jami' al-Usul, volume 10, page 330. Then we have the famous Sunni scholar of interpretation of the Quran, As-Suyuti. He mentions the following narration: لا تذهب الدنيا ولا تنقضي. This world will not come to its end حتى يملك رجل من أهل بيتي, before a man from my progeny come and rule the world. يواتو اسمه اسمي. His name is like my name.
My name.
And the narration is over. There is no reference to the father's name. This is by Suyuti in Al-Fath al-Kabir, volume 3, page 306, and also Jam' al-Ahadith, volume 8, page 157. Again, we have Ibn Kathir al-Dimashqi, another famous Sunni scholar, who has quoted this narration from Abu Huraira. The narration is the same. And after quoting the narration, he says, هذا حديث حسن صحيح. This is an authentic narration. النهاية في الفتن والملاحم, volume 1, page 24. So these are only a few Sunni scholars who have quoted this narration from Abu Huraira, one of the companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, who is highly regarded by the Sunni scholars. Now, the second companion of the Prophet who has quoted this narration, and in it he has only referred to the name of Imam Mahdi without referring to his father's name, is Ibn Mas'ud. His narration has been quoted by different people like Amr ibn Marra from Zar, from Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, with an authentic narration. Let me just share one version in this regard. We have this narration from Zar ibn Hubaysh from Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. According to him, the Holy Prophet said, the world will not come to its end until a man from my progeny will come. And يُوَافِقُ إِسْمُهُ إِسْمِي. His name is like my name. Al-Mu'jam al-Kabir by At-Tabarani, volume 10, page 131. And this is an authentic narration based on Sunni criteria. Many other Sunni scholars, they have quoted this narration. Quickly, I may refer to some names like Al-Shafi'i in Kitab al-Fawa'id, volume 4, page 383. Al-Isbahani in Hilyat al-Awliya, volume 5, page 75. And Al-Maqdisi al-Shafi'i in Iqd al-Durar, volume 1, page 90. And many other Sunni scholars like Dhahabi ibn Khaldun, and so on and so forth. So this is the second companion of the Prophet quoting this version of narration.
All right. Are seeing that Ibn Taymiyyah, the forefather of Wahhabiyyah, is adding on something on his own, and then he's claiming that Shias have deleted it, while as the other Sunni scholars, when they repeat the same narration, this line is missing in all narrations. The line is, his name is like the name of my father. So, well,
the line is not missing. We will prove that those people...
The line has been added, actually.
Yeah, those people, I mean, the other version has been distorted, and some people have added that part for some political reasons, which we'll explain, inshallah, in the following session.
Inshallah, we'll explain that in the following session. For now, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much to listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., despite concluding that it has enough evidence, the January 6th House panel is concerned that making a referral to the Justice Department would backfire by politicizing the investigation into the Capitol riot. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Michael Schmidt, Luke Broadwater, and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled, January 6th Panel Has Evidence for Criminal Referral of Trump, but Splits on Sending. The leaders of the House committee investigating the Capitol attack have grown divided over whether to make a criminal referral to the Justice Department of former President Donald J. Trump, even though they have concluded that they have enough evidence to do so, people involved in the discussions have said. The debate centers on whether making a referral, a largely symbolic act, would backfire by politically tainting the Justice Department's expanding investigation into the 6th of January assault and what led up to it. Since last summer, a team of former federal prosecutors working for the committee has focused on documenting the attack and the preceding efforts by Donald Trump and his allies to reverse his defeat in the 2020 presidential election. The panel plans to issue a detailed report of its findings, but in recent months it has regularly signaled that it was also weighing a criminal referral that would pressure Attorney General Merrick Garland to open a criminal investigation into former President Donald J. Trump. Despite concluding that they have enough evidence to refer Mr. Trump for obstructing a congressional proceeding and conspiring to defraud the American people, some on the committee are questioning whether there is any need to make a referral to the Justice Department. The Justice Department appears to be ramping up a wide-ranging investigation, and making a referral could saddle a criminal case with further partisan baggage at a time when Donald Trump is openly flirting with running again in 2024. The committee's vice chairwoman, Representative Liz Cheney, said on CNN on Sunday, 10th of April, that the committee had not reached a final decision about making referrals and downplayed any divisions on the committee, but acknowledged there was significant evidence of criminality. I think that it is absolutely the case. It is absolutely clear that what President Trump was doing, what a number of people around him were doing, that they knew it was unlawful. They did it anyway, said Liz Cheney, a Wyoming Republican. The shift in committee leaders' perspective on making a referral was prompted in part by a ruling 2 weeks ago by Judge David Carter of the Federal District Court for Central California, deciding a civil case in which the committee had sought access to more than 100 emails written by John Eastman, a lawyer who advised Donald Trump on efforts to derail certification of the Electoral College outcome. Judge David Carter found that it was more likely than not that Mr. Trump and Mr. Eastman had committed federal crimes. The ruling led some committee and staff members to argue that even though they felt they had amassed enough evidence to justify calling for a prosecution, the judge's decision would carry far greater weight with Merrick Garland, Attorney General Merrick Garland, than any referral letter they could write, according to people with knowledge of their conversations. The members and aides who were reluctant to support a referral contended that making one would create the appearance that Merrick Garland was investigating Donald Trump at the behest of a Democratic Congress, and that if the committee could avoid that perception, it should do so. Even if the final report does not include a specific referral letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland, the findings would still provide federal prosecutors with the evidence the committee uncovered, including some that has not yet become public, that could be used as a roadmap for any prosecution, the people said. If you read his decision, I think it's quite telling, Representative Zoe Lofgren, Democrat of California and a member of the House panel, said of Judge David Carter's ruling. Zoe Lofgren added, he and we have reviewed a huge amount of documents and he reached a conclusion that he outlined in very stark terms. Zoe Lofgren is among those who believe a referral letter to the Justice Department is superfluous, since it would carry no legal weight. Maybe we will, maybe we won't, she said of a referral. It doesn't have a legal impact. But the question about whether to send a referral has, for one of the first times since the committee was formed in July, exposed differences among the committee's members. Representative Elaine Luria, Democrat of Virginia and a member of the House panel, said that the committee should still send a referral for any crimes it uncovers. It would say that I don't agree with what some of my colleagues have said about this, Ms. Luria said on MSNBC this month. I think it's a lot more important to do what's right than it is to worry about the political ramifications. This committee, our purpose is legislative and oversight, but if in the course of our investigation we find that criminal activity has occurred, I think it's our responsibility to refer that to the U.S. Justice Department. Liz Cheney portrayed any divisions as minor and said the panel would work collaboratively and reach a consensus agreement. I'm confident we will work to come to an agreement, she said. Although staff members have been in discussion about a referral and some have debated the matter publicly, the committee members have not sat down together to discuss whether to proceed with a referral, several lawmakers have said. Representative Pete Aguilar, Democrat of California, said the committee was likely to hold off on making a final determination until investigators finished their work. He said the House panel was finishing up its investigative phase and shifting to a more public-facing one in which the panel will present its findings. The members haven't had those conversations, Mr. Aguilar said, of a meeting to discuss a potential referral. Right now, we're gathering the material that we need. As the investigative phase winds down, we'll have more conversations about what the report looks like, but we're not presupposing whether that's going to go before we get a little further with the interviews. Although the committee has the ability to subpoena testimony and documents and make referrals to the U.S. Justice Department for prosecutions, it has no criminal prosecution powers of its own. Liz Cheney singled out Donald Trump's conduct at a public hearing in December, reading from the criminal code and laying out how she believed he had obstructed Congress. In early March, the committee in effect road-tested whether the evidence it had gathered could support a prosecution, laying out in a filing in the civil case before Judge David Carter its position that Donald Trump and John Eastman had obstructed Congress and defrauded the American public. In validating the committee's position, legal experts said the judge made it difficult for the U.S. Justice Department to avoid an investigation. Attorney General Merrick Garland has given no public indication of the department's intentions other than to say that it will follow the facts and the law. But subpoenas issued by a federal grand jury indicate that prosecutors are gathering information about a wide array of issues, including about efforts to obstruct the election certification by people in the Trump White House and in Congress. Investigators from the House Committee and the U.S. Justice Department have not been sharing information, except to avoid conflicts around the scheduling of certain witnesses. We want them to move faster, but we respect their work, Mr. Aguilar, Democrat of California, said, adding that the committee has a different goal than that the Justice Department's inquiry. to fully investigate what led to the riot, which injured more than 150 police officers, and take legislative steps to prevent a repeat. It's an insult to the lives of the Capitol police officers if we don't pursue what happened and take meaningful and concrete steps to ensure that it doesn't happen again. Aside from the question of whether to make a referral about Donald Trump, the committee has moved aggressively to use the Justice Department to ensure that witnesses cooperate with its investigation. The committee has met criminal referrals against four Trump White House officials for their refusal to sit for questioning or hand over documents, accusing them of contempt of Congress. But the Justice Department has charged only one individual, Steve Bannon, frustrating the committee. Those frustrations played out in public at a hearing this month when Zoe Lofgren said this committee is doing its job. The Department of Justice needs to do theirs. Ms. Lofgren said she had not planned to make the remarks, but as she sat on the dais during the hearing, she decided to veer from her planned remarks because the department's slowness in addressing the contempt referrals ate at her. Some of us did express some frustration. I'm among them, she said. Honestly, I hadn't planned to say that. It wasn't my script. It wasn't there, but I thought, you know, this is frustrating. I just decided to say it. Trying to pressure the Justice Department to prosecute a contempt of Congress charge is more appropriate than other criminal referrals, Zoe Lofgren argued. It's different than doing a referral generally for prosecution, she said. When you're the victim of a crime, there is some weight to that. And when you are the victim of a criminal contempt, as the committee is, you're the victim. And so I think there was some stature to that. The committee is preparing to hold public hearings in May and June and to make a final report this September. After interviewing more than 800 witnesses, including more than a dozen Trump White House officials, the panel has another 100 interviews lined up, including some witnesses it wants to bring in a second time. Among those scheduled to testify soon is Stephen Miller, a former White House advisor to Donald Trump, who the committee says helped spread false claims of voter fraud in the election and encouraged state legislators to appoint alternate slates of electors in an effort to invalidate Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s election victory.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood
قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. Once more, Quds Day has arrived. Holy Quds calls all Muslims in the world. The truth is that as long as the surprising criminal Zionist regime is dominating over Quds, all days of the year should be considered to be Quds Day. Holy Quds is the heart of Palestine, and the entire occupied country of Palestine, from river to the sea, is a continuation of Quds. The Palestinian nation is showing every day that it has stood up and will stand up against the oppressor with an exemplary courage. The Palestinian youth have acted as a defensive shield for the Palestine with their self-sacrificing activities, and they are harbingers of a different future. We are carrying out this year's Quds Day while everything is signaling a new equation in Palestine's present and future.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Today, an invincible willpower in Palestine and throughout West Asia has replaced the invincible army of the Zionists. Today, that criminal army has been forced to turn its aggressive formation into a defensive one. In the political arena today, the most important supporter of that usurping regime, the United States of America, has suffered consecutive defeats. It has been defeated in the war in Afghanistan, defeated in its maximum pressure policy against the Islamic Republic of Iran, defeated in the face of Asian powers, defeated in trying to control the economy of the world, and defeated in the internal management of its own country and managing the phenomenon of the deep rift that has come about in the U.S. establishment. The usurping Zionist regime is wallowing in a convoluted network of problems in both political and military arenas. The former butcher and criminal who was at the top of that regime was thrown into the dustbin of history following the epic at Saif al-Quds. Every hour, his current successors await the sharp blade of another epic.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt,
Indian-administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The controversial idea of creating an EU army has now come to pass in all but name. The European Commission confirmed on Wednesday the bloc's 27 nations have agreed to jointly spend €200 billion on military hardware over the next few years.
Joint procurement is better operationally for our armed forces, because this strengthens the interoperability between the armed forces.
Citizens are struggling to survive, mainly due to the economic fallout from the conflict in Ukraine. But it appears EU authorities have other priorities.
We need modern air defences. We need drones. We need air-to-air refuelling capabilities. We need tanks and armoured vehicles. We need coastal defence.
Anti-war demonstrators in Brussels say the extra billions being spent on NATO and the EU army cannot be justified.
Just those people are saying that we have to secure ourselves. Against who? Against what? Against, I don't know.
We want Belgium out of NATO, and we want NATO out of Belgium.
The European Commission insists the EU's military spending plan will complement the work of NATO, not erode it. But military experts are saying that is inevitable, and they say the project has already seriously undermined NATO's credibility. The Commission has also just announced an additional €9 billion for the Ukrainian government.
Since the beginning of Russia's aggression on 24th of February, the EU has provided €4.1 billion to help Ukraine.
Hard-pressed EU taxpayers might wonder how the money will be spent. Last September, the bloc's financial watchdog revealed how corruption is rife in Ukraine at every level, from the government to the judiciary. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A witness to the humanitarian consequences of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Alina Duhan is the U.N. Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of the unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. On her 10-day trip to Iran, she paid a visit to 30 ministries and institutions to assess how the U.S. sanctions have affected different sectors in Iran. She described the sanctions on Iran as devastating and inhumane.
Economic challenges arising from unilateral sanctions and lack of international cooperation based on shared responsibility prevent the government of Iran from providing sustainable assistance to the most vulnerable categories of population.
In her exclusive interview to Press TV, the UN rapporteur spoke about her observations in Iran, saying the Iranian people are bearing the brunt of U.S. sanctions.
The darkest part of all that is the fact that all population of the country, regardless of the nationality, is affected by the use of sanctions, even the nationals of countries which impose sanctions. And Iranians abroad are affected. And I believe it's even worse that imposition of these comprehensive sanctions delivers the feeling of fear.
To many Iranian patients, sanctions are an unending nightmare, barring them from accessing life-saving medicine. Hundreds of thalassemia patients and people with EB, among others, are grappling with drug shortage in Iran. Many of them have died because of this problem.
Well, the United States argues that its sanctions do not target Iran's health sector directly. But the sanctions on its banking system have made it complicated for the country to purchase medical items. Does this amount to an escape route for the U.S. to shrug off its responsibility over the existing problem in Iran's health sector?
I see here two problems. So point number one, that when it comes to the banking sector, there are no proofs that they are legal. Basically, they are illegal. There are no grounds to impose these sanctions, and it's already a problem by itself. And the humanitarian impact of banking sector sanctions has been illustrated in the report and will be illustrated in more details. When it comes to the health sector, naturally, there is a general license issued by OFAC entitling the for humanitarian exceptions in the health area. However, in reality, it's nearly not possible. It's not possible because of the number of issues. The very first one, to deliver humanitarian goods, you still need to get OFAC license in many of the cases. And getting OFAC license is very lengthy. You need to consult lawyers or people who used to deal with OFAC license. Responses come within several years.
Alina Duhan started her mandate as a UN rapporteur in March 2020. Ever since, she has paid similar visits to four other countries, including Zimbabwe and Venezuela. UN rapporteurs are appointed by the UN as freelancers and are not affiliated to and paid by the UN. That's why Ms. Duhan promised that her report will not be influenced by politics.
Ms. Duhan cited countless instances of the humanitarian side effects of U.S. sanctions on Iran, dismissing the move as a tool to achieve political gains. Tehran now views Ms. Duhan as an independent and internationally endorsed witness to the issue, urging her to report it as it is to the U.N. Human Rights Council. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
As they go about their day, millions of Britons are consumed with one big question: how to make ends meet in the year ahead as the impact of the cost of living crisis kicks in.
It brings a lot of frustration because we know that energy companies, like very recently BP and other companies, are posting the highest ever profits. So it almost feels really unfair. And definitely it's going to have an impact on some families.
I can't even saving, now you've got to allocate that money for other places, you know, for feeding your family, your kids. Everything's gone up, petrol's gone up. So houses now, you might have to put that in a back burner or wait a bit to until things better.
The cost of living crisis has barely begun, but the alarm bells are already ringing.
The numbers are pretty stark. Inflation is at a 30-year high. Thousands of people could face eviction as that inflation could feed through into the housing market. More than 5 million Britons already have to choose between food and heating, as the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey warns of apocalyptic food prices in the months ahead.
Not everyone is impacted. Bearing the brunt, low-income households, not only on their finances, but also on their health. The stress from soaring energy and food costs is preventing one in two people in Britain from looking after their well-being, with some even not affording to travel to hospital.
I can't sleep at night. Last night I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I've been up since then because of these prices. It's just, you know, what can you do?
The culprit for all this, a cocktail of Brexit, the pandemic and the Russian military conflict in Ukraine. Britain was one of the first countries banning Russian energy imports. The impact of that decision now felt by the people here.
The government really needs to look into this thoroughly, how they can help people out there to find a job. People that have lost their businesses along the line, they need to look into that as well, how to maybe they need to sustain them, provide funding.
The UK government says it's providing support worth over $24 billion within the next year to help families with the pressures from the increasing cost of living. The big question is, will it work? Saeed Purza, London.
Rising electricity, gas, oil, petrol and food prices are drastically pushing the standard of living down for millions of citizens across the 27-nation EU. The European Commission's flagship annual conference focusing on the economy has been told things could get much worse.
In addition to the fact that the war could escalate, sanctions and counter-sanctions could create further problems, there is also the fact that in China, growth is slowing.
The Brussels Economic Forum 2022 also heard that financial pressures, mainly resulting from the conflict in Ukraine, are disproportionately impacting young adults in precarious jobs.
We're picking up incredible increases and disconcerting increases in anxiety, stress, depression, burnouts.
Some analysts suggest untold misery is being piled on citizens because the West purposely ignored Russia's legitimate security concerns. We have been seeking opinions on the current economic pressures.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
It will go until the point where people understand, okay, this is the peak, we cannot do anymore, and then let's see what's happened. I don't know.
Not only the energy, but the prices of food, the prices of transport. So everything is much more higher.
Driving the EU's foreign policy, critics say Washington has put the bloc in an unwinnable situation. There was no mention of that by key speakers at the Brussels conference.
Thanks to our unity, we have seen that swift and sweeping sanctions can have enormous force.
Enormous force for who? Russia's currency, the ruble, is doing very well, and the Federation is benefiting from rising energy prices. Experts warn of catastrophe if the Kremlin decides to cut off its gas supplies to the EU. As one contributor at the Brussels Economic Forum put it, there is no economy without energy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Palestine Embassy in Rome has placed in its premises a condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akla. Shirin was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shirin's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shirin personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shirin. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shirin's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shirin Abu Akla, omitting Israel's responsibility and considering as facts only the statement issued by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shirin is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that expose the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
Final results of Lebanon's parliamentary elections are out, with Hezbollah and its allies securing at least half of the seats in the legislative body. The Minister of Interior stressed that the election process was complex and difficult, but free and fair.
With regards to the percentage of voters and the population of Lebanon and the circumstances surrounding the elections, it was a successful election and can be considered a significant achievement. The incidents which took place are marginal and very few in relation to the number of districts and polling stations and ballot boxes, which were around 6,900. These elections were fair and credible.
Despite the political silence during the declaration of the results, analysts believe commotion is yet to come.
Despite of the results, which are almost a tie, I believe that the other camp will keep trying to promote this agenda of disarming Hezbollah. And of course, on the other hand, Hezbollah will try to fail their plans. But while doing so, the Americans and their allies in Lebanon will further deteriorate the economic situation as to blame Hezbollah.
Newcomers to the parliament include members of civil society, which are reportedly sponsored by the United States. The Lebanese forces and its allies also secured a relatively large bloc and could step up their anti-resistance rhetoric.
They were sponsored by the United States, and part of the sponsorship is to promote this agenda, which is to call for disarming Hezbollah as a means to isolate Lebanon from the Arab-Israeli struggle and facilitate the deal of the century to pass.
The new parliament is set to meet within 15 days to elect its executive council and a speaker of the parliament. In the aftermath of the Lebanese parliamentary elections, many fear that the polarization reflects